Let's get going. Ezra, right, whenever you are. All right. Open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Today is March 26, 2009. I would say it's 8 a.m., but I'd be fictional, so I'm not going to say that. It's close. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2424. This was carried over from Tuesday to resolve some confusion regarding the amendments that were up for consideration in our fiscal. Measure should now be ready to move, but did we even adopt the amendments? We have not yet adopted them.
Great. You want to adopt them?
Please, Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2424.
Representative Krieger moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/20/09. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2424 be moved to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2424 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Roblin.
Aye.
Representative Shoffman.
Excused.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Arnam.
Excused.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Chair Clement.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill is sent to the floor as amended. I think Representative Wisnett would probably like to carry this. We'll sign Representative Wisnett as the carrier. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2904. And we have Representative Kotek with us. Would you please join us?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's a pleasure to be before you today, and I would really appreciate the quick opportunity to hear House Bill 2904. It's not often that an urban legislator like myself comes and talks to you about farming. But let me tell you a little bit about my district. I represent most of North Portland, a little bit of Northeast, and my district, as you're getting, if you can think of driving across the I-5 bridge into Vancouver, right before you would do that, around where Portland Meadows is and the Delta Park softball fields. If you go a little east of that, it's a lovely neighborhood called East Columbia. It's along the slough. There's a golf course and some neighborhoods. It's also a farm. The Fazio Farms has been around for decades, and I'm here on behalf of my constituents who have been dealing with a very specific situation that I think could have and does have statewide significance when we're looking at farms who are trying to make a go of their land but have run into issues and have had to keep their lands unfarmed for several years to mitigate particular issues. And you're going to get all the details from my constituents, from the Fazios themselves, and dealing with a particular property tax issue with Multnomah County. And I just want you to I really appreciate this discussion this morning because I think it's important to do what we can to support small farms, to support what we value in Portland, which is the ability to have farms within the urban growth boundary, and I'm very happy to have them in my district. And we're going to also hear from neighbors today who really like having that type of neighbor to look at and enjoy. And again, I'm not going to go into details. We have the folks here, and we also have folks from the county today to talk about the particular tax issue and proposed amendments. And I will just say thank you for your time and due consideration. And I think you'll be really impressed with this story and why we need a fix. So thank you very much.
Questions for our colleague? Okay.
So that was just a teaser.
I'm going to call Anthony Fazio, Carol Levine, and Judy Richardson.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Let me get these packet materials.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative Gilliam is staring at me. Please make him stop.
So ordered.
He was only trying to protect himself from the bug that's going around, and he felt if he kept an eye on him, he wouldn't have to worry about where he was.
It's been called worse things than a bug.
If he was moving this direction, he would evacuate the building. So. I'll defend you.
Thank you, sir.
So, Anthony Fazio is who I have first. I assume that's you.
Is it okay if I go first? I'm Carol Levine.
If you would like.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. We really appreciate the opportunity to appear here today. And
First thing I need to have you do is tell us who you are.
Okay.
Though I said it. But
that's fine. My name is Carol Levine. I'm a tax lawyer. My address is 18570 Getz Road in Gladstone, Oregon. And I'm here representing the Fazios. In support of House Bill 2904.
Please, thank you.
Okay. Again, we really do appreciate the opportunity to be able to explain and for Mr. Fazio to tell their story because it truly is remarkable. I first met the Fazios a little bit over a year ago. After they had filed an appeal from the county disqualifying their farm for farmland special assessment. They had filed an appeal. They needed help from a tax lawyer, and that's how I got involved and how I met them. Along the way, I learned a lot about this family as well as their farm and their whole situation. Again, it's very remarkable. They've been farming for almost 100 years in that area, and the vast majority of their farm is in EFU zone. But they do have two parcels that are in non-EFU zone, and that was changed to non-EFU about 15 years ago. Well, about 10 years or so ago, Mr. Fazio noted that they were having problems with the cucumber, pickling cucumbers that they were growing on these two parcels. And he got the OSU Extension Service involved. They did some testing and found out what the problem was. And basically, they put together a plan to try to remediate it, the situation. And Anthony can go in and explain, you know, more in detail the steps that he took, but it really was extraordinary, a lot of expense. There were times along the way that they could have just said, you know, we're going to give up. We're just not going to worry about farming this parcel. But farming is in their blood. That's what they want to do. And so they have worked very hard to get clean soil in, to take care of the problems that they had, and start farming again. And they, in fact, early last year, were able to plant all but 4 acres of these two parcels. Well, around 2007, Multnomah County came out. They noticed that the land hadn't been, these parcels had not been planted for quite some time, and that there was a landfill operation on there, which Anthony will again explain the whole purpose for that. And without any discussion, investigation, they just simply disqualified those two parcels from the farmland special assessment. And to give you an idea of the impact, just for the 2007 year and again in 2008 year, the difference in their tax bill is about $350,000.
Did you just say $350,000 on two parcels?
Yeah. That's the difference between the tax as being farm.
That's not the tax. That's the assessed value.
No, tax.
It's expensive property.
Yeah, clearly.
Holy yeah. For 1 year, okay, the amount of tax that they paid for 1 year before disqualification is $11,180. After disqualification, $165,000. They simply cannot continue farming with that sort of tax burden. So what the Fazios did when they found out that the county said, well, we're going to disqualify you, they spread the rest of the soil out, they got the fields ready for planting, and they did, in fact, plant in 2008. They reapplied for farmland special assessment, and then were told that they were going to be denied, that they were denied because they weren't in farm production as of 1/1/08, like anybody is out there getting fields prepared as of that date. And then, to add insult to injury, the county sent out personal property tax folks who then looked at the machinery and equipment that the Fazios were using in this whole remediation process and issued personal property tax assessments, not only for the current year, but then they went back 5 years. And those, the omitted property assessments alone for 5 years were $139,000, and that includes penalties and interest. And then it would be $17,000 per year after that. So, again, we started the appeal process, and as we got further involved in it, the county, through their lawyer, Jed Tompkins, began to work with the Fazios to try to come up with some way to resolve the issues outside of litigation. And we're still in that phase right now. One of the things that you'll see in the packet of materials, well, there are a couple things I think are very important. One is a letter from McReynolds, from the OSU Extension Center, who did work closely with Anthony to come up with a plan and monitor it. And he's, as you'll be able to read his letter, he was very supportive of it. During this process where we were working with the county, the assessor asked the Department of Revenue's specialist to review their actions and basically let them know if their actions were appropriate. And so you'll see in that packet as well a letter from Gary Wright at the Department of Revenue to the assessor's office that I think does a very good job of explaining every issue and the way he sees that it needs to be resolved under current law. And you see also through his letter that he says it's clear that the Fazios have intended to return their land to farming. And of course, in fact, they have returned most of it. They're still trying to wind up the last piece of this. So basically, what we decided, because of the way the law reads now, that the best way to get this resolved is through legislation. And basically, you know, I believe it's not going to, this is, this will impact non-EFU farmers throughout the state that have severe problems that would keep them from being able to farm. So problems that keep them from farming but can be fixed. And, again, the Extension Center is on board with it. The Department of Revenue would under the bill, would propose rules to establish the procedure for the review of these plans and so forth. And so we just respectfully request that the committee, again, we're new to this process. We're kind of learning as we go, but we just really respectfully request that this bill be passed.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Krieger.
How much have they actually had to pay in additional tax? I mean, they're being billed for more. Have they actually had to put out some extra dollars?
Well, this is not, if you're thinking about that potential additional tax, this is not the potential additional tax. They have not been able to pay this tax bill. They did pay last fall, when they got the omitted property assessments that go back 5 years, and then they also got the assessment for the for the 2008, I believe, tax year. And they were given 30 days to pay it, or the county was going to put it to warrant. And so they did pay roughly $17,000.
Follow up.
The effective date of the bill is, 90 days after signing? I would suggest that we have it amended back to whatever year we need to, so they pay any tax more than they should have.
It's possible Section 5, which says this section applies to tax years July 1, 07, does that do that?
Well, no. What that does is it takes care of the real property issues, but it does not address all of the omitted property assessments.
You'd address it all.
We're going to try and get through all the testimony before we start talking about amendments. But, yeah, I hear what you're saying. Absolutely.
Sure. So I would turn things over to Anthony Fazio.
Please. Yeah. Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Anthony Fazio. My address is 8433 Northeast 13th Avenue, Portland. And I'm with Fazio Farms, our family farm. And thank you, committee and Representative Clem, for allowing me to speak. I was just going to start in here a little bit and see if I can tell you a little bit about why we did this and how we went about it. Fusarium wilt, if you're not familiar with it, I wish I wasn't, because first thing they tell you to look for, they mean the guys you talk to in the field, like a field representative for a chemical fertilizer company, and then you get Bob McReynolds from OSU involved in the labs and take tests. And first the chemical reps tell you that it's this, spray this, spray that, spray this, put this on there, and then you try and nothing works. Then you get a guy that's more familiar with, like Bob McReynolds, and he comes out and he pulls a root up and cuts it. It's like a molar. You see four vascular or tubes there coming up the stem, and he said, you see that? It's brown. It's tarnished. All four of them are tarnished. Mm. And they should be bright white. I said, what does that mean? He says, well, what the plant does, it's accumulating in its vascular system. So when it's building this nice frame of vines and leaves, we're really getting excited because it's getting close to plant harvest time. And you're looking at that going, wow, this is going to be a good year. This is really going to be a good year. Look at those. The crew's all happy and excited. And then right about the day you pick, you start seeing a silver leaf. The bottom of the leaf kind of turns up, and you see a silver underneath. It doesn't look like the wind maybe blew it over, and it's hot, and you think they need water. So, yeah, we just irrigated not that long, so we hit them again. You go in there and pick, and then it looks like, you know, I start getting on the crew. I said, hey, guys, take it easy on the vines. It looks, well, so we haven't picked that part yet. So you pick it, and then you come out there in the afternoon, and they just wilting, and you wait three or four days and pick again, and there's less yet, and they're starting to get crooked and nubby. And then you go out the third time, and they're starting to show crispy brown. The fourth time, they're all nubby, crooked, hardly anything there. Three declining picks, normally get about 12 to 15 picks off a field. And you're going, what happened? Well, when the fruit starts to set, that's the biggest demand for water, and it can't get the water through those vascular tubes. They're all plugged up. So it robs it from the plant. It takes it from the leaves and the stems, and that's why they start to droop and wilt and turn crispy brown. The plant's just trying to survive to the next year to grow one fruit, get a seed out there that cures and dries up and stays there for the winter to start next year. That's their thinking, the plant. So you walk away from a field that you basically never recover the cost out of. You just kind of think, geez, I hope it doesn't happen to the rest of them. And it starts in spots, and they start to see it happen, and it gets really depressing. And at this location in Portland, we had our packing line, our cooler, all set up. So we decided that we're going to have to move it to the Savvy Island portion of our farm unit to be closer to the cucumbers and the crew. So we moved everything, and that's quite costly. Now we're starting to see it at Savvy's Island. And so thinking about how to resolve this, I mean, in the past, another county rep guy, a county extension guy said, Anthony, I don't know why, you don't plant, you pick strawberries here in town. And I said, well, I did, and they got root rot, and I lost them all. The ground's too low. So you can't plant winter wheat. It's too low. The geese will eat it. Because spring wheat, like last spring, was so wet, Fortunately, we got a great fall and got the harvest off of it, but sometimes it's too wet in the springtime to get a crop in there. Cucumbers is a 65-day crop. It's a short-season crop. You can get them in and get them out of there normally. But we're kind of bound by what we could do there. Plus, we're known in the market for pickling cucumbers up and down the West Coast. If somebody asked, where can I get some pickling cucumbers, they say Fazio. So that's what we do and we're known for. So, and starting to try to study and ask the questions, you know, what do you do about fusarium? Well, how can we resolve it? Start doing some searches and looking at what University of Ohio says, University of Iowa, the East Coast. It varies from, you know, being out of cucurbits. That means pumpkins, zucchini, all that. That's related. You got to be out, I think Oregon State says 6 or 7 years. Another one says 12 years. Another one says 15 years. Another one says never. You never get rid of it. And we had our own experiment. We had a 40-acre piece that we rented, and the guy before us that rented it just farmed it to death with those crops. So we planted grain and sweet corn for 12 years. No cucurbits for 12 years. You go and plant it, gone, the whole thing. So with the growing at Salvi's Island, starting in there, we thought, well, let's start this project in town, since the close proximity to excavation projects, so we're not disrupting any ecosystem anywhere to get the soil that we would need. And so we started this process, and we thought, okay, we're farmers. We represent the soil world. The excavation guys represent the dirt world. So I'm going to go to Wilkins Trucking and talk to Mike Wilkins and see what he knows about availability of soil. Mike says, I got a 30,000-yard job. I got a 90,000-yard job. I've got 240s down the list. And I thought, wow, he's got enough soil to do it in 1 year. Perfect. All from downtown Portland, which is mainly sandy loam soil. Well, we started off with Wilkins, and by the end of that dry season, we got less than 2,000 yards. He was selling it, moving it all over the place. Not son of a gun. So I devised a plan the next year, thinking, I'm going to do this myself. I knew this guy named Bruce Hubble. He was a farm boy out of Wyoming, and he started working at the excavation business companies, and then he eventually started his own. So we knew each other for about a year, and then I told him that I was going to start this, and he heard that Ken Leahy offered to operate the landfill. And he thought, well, I should do it. I know Anthony, I'm going to do it. So he comes and makes me a proposal. Well, he starts in, we do a little contract agreement, and he starts in on the thing, and you know, it was a learning curve for him too, but he knew more about landfills than I did. And I thought we could stay focused on the...
No, go ahead.
Oh, I thought you were talking.
All right. The people will come in and out.
Excuse me. And so we could stay focused on farming and other things. We're going to do a little agritourism stuff. And then Hubble was kind of... He didn't do a lot. He was focused on his excavation business, and I had to get in there and kind of pound on his people a little bit during the wintertime to catch up. Then after 2000, the September 11th thing happened, he lasted about 1 year, and then he went broke. His excavation business broke him. He tells me all of his equipment's going to be repossessed. What about the landfill equipment? Nothing. That's it. We're stuck with 75,000 tons of rubble, because what happened was, you think that you're going to get this sandy loam soil, this nice soil, and you know, somebody comes at lunchtime, and they go out there and dump their load. You check it from the top, maybe see 10-15% of that load. They go dump that load. There might be 10 loads. You come back from lunch, you push it, and there's a big chunk of concrete in there, or two or three. And again, what are you going to do with that? You kick it off to the side, and you worry about it later. Then later comes, there's quite a bit. So Hubble had stacked up a bunch of this stuff. And he told me about a year into the process, he says, you know, Anthony, we've got to start taking concrete and asphalt. I know you don't want that stuff, but you got to be full service to these...
Our cell phones start bugging us.
You got to be full service to these contractors. And you got to take... So they might have to cut through some asphalt.
Actually, Terry, could you tell Paulette I'm chairing a committee right now? Thanks. Go ahead.
You got to cut through asphalt to put utility work in or to do a building. They got to demo a building. They take about maybe 5-10 loads of concrete. but they might have 100 loads of dirt. And he said, we can use that to build roads and all this stuff. And okay, if it's going to help, take it. You got it handled? Well, he goes broke, and he leaves me with about 75,000 tons of rubble piled and scattered throughout the fields. He's broke. Do we ask the question, do we chase after him? Do we look to a government body for help? You know, we're basically farmers with a few agricultural pieces of equipment. We don't have any of this industrial equipment. So we mustered up enough money to buy a used dozer. Everything we got is used. And we started to take care of the customers that were still coming in, but this concrete's mounding. So then we thought, okay, let's study recycling. Let's crush this stuff. We can use the gravel at the farm for the roads, parking lots, building pads, sell some, attract guys. A lot of guys will have to bring a load of dirt because they know they can haul a load of gravel back. So I'll start studying the recycling. So I started off by hiring a guy to crush. But they want their money in 30 days. And we're not known for gravel sales, so we're going to be hit with this burden of $50,000 and not be able to recover the money probably for a year and a half to 2 years. So I started thinking about, okay, let's. That guy didn't crush a very good job, but look at the material. And I said, you know, that looks kind of dirty to me. Is this marketable? He goes, well, maybe we should wait till it dries out. We'll come back in June. They didn't come back until October when it started raining. So I thought, I'm going to rent my own crusher. You get this crusher coming in, and this bearings are going back on the tail pulley. They're going out. It's getting, yeah, I'm starting really going nuts because I think I can crush this pile in 1 month, and it's taken two or three and still not getting it done. So I had to take that away. And so I started looking around trying to find out the best, if I could afford a crusher. Because we can crush what comes in 1 year, what comes into our landfill just a little bit, we can crush in 2 weeks. So if we crushed in the spring for a week and a fall in the week, we're caught up. But we're bringing the stuff still out of the field as we level and clean and prep and rip.
And once you get your soil up, then you're done with this.
Pardon me?
Once you get your soil up, then you're done.
Yeah.
This is trying to get the soil up and get the rock out, and then you're done.
Yeah, and I kind of liken it to these guys, and there's areas that are real rocky. Our farm of Sauvy Island is not very rocky, but over on Oak Island, part of Sauvy's Island, there's really a lot of round rock. I've seen Bennett Farms in eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, that have a lot of rock. Those guys got rock pickers, rock scoops on the front of their dozers when they're hauling it out of the field. And I know some guys have hired mobile track crushers to come in and crush that rock up, and they use some, they sell some to their neighbors, and they use it up. I kind of liken it to that. This material's coming in. We didn't even take anything that was mixed with concrete and dirt. We didn't even take that for the first year or two. But when I bought the screening plant, because you crush the concrete, then it goes into a screening plant. So it's $20,000 more for a track option, so I could move it to a pile away from the crusher. And I thought, okay, if I take in, I can increase the soil intake by taking the dirt mixed with concrete and asphalt or other aggregate. And I could screen that. It's going to be costly, but I could use the same screen for two purposes. I could move it over to that mixed pile, screen that stuff, and then use the screen soil for the top dressing of the field, take the aggregate over to the crusher and crush it. So, and that's the way we bought it. And in 5 years, I think we've got about maybe 300 hours on this crushing setup. That's nothing. That's nothing. And I was accused by the county of having a commercial crushing operation. I mean, well, it's easy to come along in the end and point fingers, but it wasn't easy getting to this point. And I'm quite proud of what we've done for being farmers to come along and finish this project up that I thought was going to be done by, you know, the other guys that knew what they were doing.
Well, I just want to make sure I got the right, the piece that we're talking about, at any moment you could just build houses on it. It's in the UGB, you can get it changed and just grow houses instead of crops at any time.
It's industrially zoned, general industrial, IG2.
There's some sort of commercial activity.
Yeah, there's FedEx next door, there's Oak Harbor.
You'd get really wealthy if you did that, but I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. But, I mean, it's not easy on farmers to resist the temptation once you're in the UGB to just turn it into something else.
Every year we got 1 to 6 real estate guys coming and inquiring about it.
Sure.
And my mom and dad live at this location, it's home. That's where I grew up, walking in the fields with a little BB gun and chasing after stuff. And, you know, it's home. Even though you see it all around, there's still deer there. There's geese and ducks that come, coyotes, rabbits. Yeah, still I tell my nephews, I say, this is where you guys are lucky that you're still growing up around here. We can still run around and chase each other with paintball guns or whatever and still have fun. So, and then, you know, they get to learn to run some construction equipment. I said, you guys don't miss this chance to do this because I never had this chance, and it's only going to be here for just a few years. So it's interesting, and we're doing a pretty good job. And to take that that land that was just abandoned by Hubco Excavation, and it had mattresses and all kinds of crap dumped in there. People were, so we've solid put concrete blocks around the boundaries. We've cleaned everything up and got a field crop planted, and now we're just sweeping ourselves into the corner to where we can try to finish this thing up. The stuff that he brought in, they weren't recycle-minded, so it was very dirty. So we had to set up a little screening plant off the side of the crusher and side discharge the dirty fines out, and we screen them and get the gravel and send the fines out to use the landfill. It's quite challenging. Like some people say, you know, you make it look easy. Well, that's because you're not here. You know, you guys show up and you see the hard work. You know, can you fabricate and trying to build something to make it work, or the crusher has a problem? I'm used to farm equipment, which is really simple and kind of light. And this heavy stuff is intimidating.
So you can't, my father-in-law, he passed away recently, but he's a farmer, you know, many years. And he's kind of a tinkerer, and he invents his own stuff and welds his own devices sometimes. Are you a tinkerer?
I have to be.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford to. You know, I had a guy come out and weld something last fall on it because I just couldn't get to it. He gave us a bill, I think it was $500. I'm like, God, a little bit of welding for $500. Look at the millions I've saved. Okay, so.
We probably should, although I'm enjoying this thoroughly, so. I do want to hear from your neighbors.
Okay, so.
They're pretty excited.
Here's a jar of Fazio Old Fashioned Barrel Dills.
My grandfather started in 1921 his pickle plant called Columbia Pickle and Packing. And
when were you hit at Century Farm?
I think in 10 years.
Yeah. My mother-in-law's claiming she's not leaving the orchard till we hit it, and it's only like 4 years or 5 years from now. Yeah.
So this, my grandfather started hit in the fresh market like we are now, and he had an abundance of pickling cucumbers. Didn't know what to do with them all. So this German man that cooked for his crew told him that, why don't you make pickles? And he says, I don't know how. He says, I do. Here's what we need. So he went and bought the barrels and all the ingredients, started making pickles, threw it into Columbia Pickle and Packing Company. Went from 21 to 53 when he passed away. The family ran it for 4 more years, then sold out the Nally's. And my dad there worked at the pickle plant, and he still continued to make a barrel or two every year. So a couple of years ago, we started, the little ones don't ship too well to L.A. or wherever, so they kind of break down and slime up. So we decided to make pickles again back into barrels and on the little ones. So that's what that about. So I could talk a long time. So if, was there any questions, or am I missing something here, Carol, that I think it's important?
I think, you know, he also included in the packet is kind of an outline of what he came to talk about today. So there are some details of what, you know, the whole remediation plan and how we got here in here that you can find in the packet. But if you have any specific questions.
And if we have any after the county, it's really just the county from, well, neighbor, and then the county, and then we could have them come back up too if we have questions.
Has the remediation worked? Have you planted any of the places that you've gotten fixed?
We've got about 90% planted in wheat last year.
Okay.
And I was going to say, the beautiful thing about this now is not only is it good for pickling cucumbers, since it's high and well-drained and crowned, now strawberries is a viable deal for you.
Oregon strawberries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I are always in on the Oregon strawberries.
Yeah. And then we're thinking maybe a pumpkin patch and corn maize, right, and different things, because it's with the way things are with the people, you know, the economy, it's a close-in deal.
Yeah.
With that, we'd have to make our roads again, because all our roads got covered up, which the recycled gravel would work good for that. Our parking lots, and we're going to try to stockpile at Savvy's Island, so we have a nice pile of gravel before we're finished crushing. So it's It's been nice to have the gravel for the farm, because there's things we gravel that we'd never be able to afford to gravel.
Yeah.
Well, we could solve a lot of problems between the gravel and farmers. We have some problems between gravel and farmers in other places. You worked it out fairly well there. Oh, boy.
Okay.
Any more questions for Anthony at the moment? Okay. Please. Well, thank you, Anthony.
Hi. My name is Judy Richardson, and I'm the neighbor at 8500 Northeast 13th. And I've been a neighbor for 17 years. And it is a joy to live next to a farm. I also own 8 acres, and I raise lavender, and I sell it at the farmer's market. And I worked for them packing pickles in their little shed before it was all moved. And just listening to the history, and the neighborhood will drive around just to look at the fields and watch them be watered. It's very good for our community. And so, and I've watched this whole process. I've listened to this for years.
And you're not suing him or anything else?
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's great.
Not at all. It's proud. You're proud of this. So.
I'm not going to talk about some of my neighbors, but they yell a lot when it's harvest time and you're out there at 7 in the morning, and they somehow think because they moved out and renting a house near an orchard that I shouldn't be out there at that hour trying to get the fruit off the trees. I'm like, why did you move here? Why are you only paying $150 a month rent to live right in the middle of somebody's orchard? I don't know what to tell you, but maybe
well,
you
we
move.
Have the neighbors will come around when there's any kind of activity and noise, but then they end up staying and watching. It's very cool.
Okay.
And
there's
a copy of her letter in the packet, along with a copy of a letter from Dick Schaefer, who is also another neighbor.
And also working at the farmers market, you hear all the input. People are so into the city farmers. Where they're situated is so ideal and so close in for kids, schools, anything, to come and visit a real active farm. Okay. I've had this little kids come to my farm just, you know, to... They've never seen a chicken. They've never seen horses. It's a good thing.
Representative Gilliam.
Just a quick question. Is Representative Kotek your representative as well?
Mm-hmm. Me? Yes.
Yeah, as compelling as the testimony is so far, I'm supportive. I'm just unbelievably excited to welcome a great colleague into the rural caucus.
I agree.
There's just a number of things here that are really...
There really are some good things.
She's the chief sponsor of Farm to School for the last session, too. You got to give her a little love here.
All right.
My goodness. Okay. Yeah, it's just him.
That's right.
We kind of like him, but boy.
We put up a
he comes from another place.
Yeah. He's got lots of farms. He's got lots of farms.
Yeah. I do have one more thing to add that Carol brought to my attention. When I started to explain to her when we first started to talk on the phone about what I was doing, and she followed along pretty good. And then we thought that it would be best if she came out and took a tour of the operation to see what's going on. And then she looked at me and she says, you know, I really didn't really grasp this 100% until I took the tour. And she said, I'm taking a little tour, and then I understand exactly everything that you're trying to accomplish. So if someone just drives by and looks, and it's not the same as actually coming in and having the full understanding of what we tried to do.
Okay, so we may have you back up again if we have questions, but thank you for coming down and spending
thank
your
you
morning
very
with
much.
Us.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time.
So I've got Jed Tompkins and Randy Walruff.
Good morning. Thank you, Claire Chim.
That's happened yesterday. It happened yesterday. It happened last week.
Done so far. 2 days in a row.
It's going to Claire.
That's a good name.
Excuse me.
No worries.
Thank you, Chair Clement, members of the committee. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am Randy Waller from Multnomah County Assessor and the Director of our Division of Assessment, Recording, and Taxation. We're here today because the county supports the central concept of House Bill 2904, but we request that the bill be amended. The bill was drafted on behalf of the owners of Fazio Farms, and we have been working with their representative in coming to an agreement on the amendments, and my understanding is that I think we have general agreement and support for the amendments. I wanted to add, as I move into this, farms and the regulation of the special assessment for farm programs is a difficult task that assessors throughout the state are tasked with. It's a special assessment program that has a lot of complexity to it. If you look at the statutes, which I'm sure the majority of you probably have, they become quite convoluted and difficult to understand at times. We do our best on those, and we appreciate this opportunity to partake in helping to correct what appears to be an oversight in the laws. Under the current law, farmland is disqualified from special assessment if it lies fallow for more than 1 year. House Bill 2904 would prevent this disqualification when severe adverse conditions on land prevent this farming, and the measures required to return the land would take more than 1 year to implement. As we noted earlier, we support the concept, but as introduced, we believe the bill leaves certain issues unresolved which can and should be addressed through the amendment of the bill. We have been working with the Fazio's representative to craft proposed amendments that would continue to grant the Fazio's the relief they seek and address the county's concerns. We've included the proposal with the hard copies of the testimony today. A brief overview of our concerns is there's two primary ones. First, the bill, as originally drafted, sets no time period within which a remediation plan must be implemented. Farm use special assessment is premised on the occurrence of farming. The duration of remediation plan should be limited so as to ensure a return to farming in the relatively near term. Second, the bill provides no assurance that the farmer will return to farming the land after completion of the remediation plan. As drafted, a farmer could misuse the bill to retain special assessment while converting the land to a non-farm use under the auspice of remediation. Misuse would unfairly place the farmer in a better position than other farmers who do not benefit from special assessment while converting the use of their land. Our proposed amendments, as in Appendix A to the testimony, are intended to replace the provisions of House Bill 2904 as introduced and provide for the following. First, prevent disqualification from farm use special assessment when land must lay fallow for more than 1 year in order to mitigate or remedy a condition on land that prohibits the farm use that occurred on the land prior to the onset of the adverse condition. Some of the highlights are mitigation or remediation of the adverse condition will comply with a remediation plan certified by the Oregon State University Extension Service or other agency designated by the Oregon State Department of Revenue. The duration of the plan shall be 3 years or, upon a showing of good cause, 5 years. No income requirements will be imposed on land subject to a remediation plan. The proposal is retroactive to the 2007-2008 tax year. Counties shall not be liable for interest on any refunds for past tax years. Second, it protects against misuse of the remediation plan by increasing the number of years for which additional taxes will be calculated upon disqualification. Once this land is returned to farm use for the same number of years of remediation, the increased additional taxes will be reduced to the level provided under current law. Finally, it provides for an exemption under ORS 307.3941 of machinery and equipment reasonably necessary to and exclusively used for the implementation of a remediation plan. However, going forward, machinery and equipment used for both remediation and some other commercial or industrial purposes will only be 50% exempt. Our concern there is that farm equipment traditionally needs to be used exclusively in a farm use operation. Again, I thank you for your time. A few other factors that would come into play. Going back to 2007 solves the real property problem here. Assessors as a whole have issues with retroactive tax relief due to the fact that there can be a lot of unintended consequences, and we do not know how many other types of properties could be impacted, and revenue that has already been collected and distributed to the taxing districts would need to be refunded depending on what other unforeseen claims could come. To go back further, as an example for equipment, we have not been able to survey the assessors around the state. We are in the middle of doing that now for what other types of farms and how, to what extent could this impact your counties. The equipment exemption as it is now would go back to 2007. To go back further, we just would not know what types of claims could be made across the state on equipment that has previously been taxed that could possibly be subject to a refund. I believe that this is a good balance to solve this problem, and I thank you for your time, and we could answer questions. Jed is with me. He helped draft all this, and you could also answer questions.
So let me ask one quick question. I'm sure we'll have some more, but do you have any problem on the remediation plan in the and we're not in a work session, so I guess I don't have to do this here, but just I'll ask one question like this, and then we can talk about it later. The I was certified by the Oregon State University or other agency designated by revenue. I think I'd feel a lot more comfortable if it was the Department of Agriculture who was deciding what's remediation on a farm than revenue, because the motives are different. And actually in agriculture, depending on if it's Jim Johnson or not, it'll be tighter and harsher to make sure it's really farming, because they're pretty uptight about making sure it's real farming, which this is clearly real farming.
I wouldn't have a problem with that.
No.
That sounds like an excellent suggestion.
Or. Ag or. Oh, yeah, right.
Because the revenue might have already addressed the particular one.
Other questions for these gentlemen?
Representative Roblin. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your preview, your county, any other pieces of land that you think for any reason would fall under this particular amendment?
Not at this time.
Okay. Or even past? Do you see any back to 207?
Not in our county.
Okay. I just wanted to check on that one.
Yeah. Might work. Representative, anybody?
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair.
Lots of thanks to the agenda.
Representative Gilliam.
Thanks. Thanks for being here. You used the phrase showing of good cause to extend the time from 3 to 5 years. Do you use that phrase in any other tax issues in Multnomah County?
I'll let you.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, Jed Tompkins, Assistant Multnomah County Attorney. I took that phrase directly from a tax statute that is relates to tax court jurisdiction over matters. It's a provision that allows folks to get into tax court if they've missed some other key deadlines, which represent the more normal process of appealing. So I took it word for word.
Follow up?
Representative Gillen, follow up.
If you did need to show good cause, it would be to the county in this case, correct?
The way the Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, Jed Tompkins, the way it's designed, the assessor, an application will ultimately be made to the assessor to for purposes of administering the special assessment program. And the criteria that a plan would meet are listed in there, but the plan will come to the assessor certified by the Extension Service or some other agency, and essentially it'll be a checking off that the plan does meet all these criteria by the assessor at that time. So I think the idea would be that if there is a need to go beyond the 3 years, the good cause would be documented and approved by OSU Extension or other agency, and that seal of approval would then beyond the document that would be before the assessor. And there's no intent in this statute for the assessor to substitute the assessor's judgment for the expertise of folks who are in the agricultural industry.
Thank you.
Mr. Sanford-Oblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other concern I had is that you talked about if they used the equipment strictly for the farm, then there would be no assessment. But if it was used at all outside of the farm purposes, then you would have a 50% charge of the personal property tax. The concern that I have is there should be, from my perspective, I would look at a threshold. I mean, if I'm there and I have people in my other farms next that need the gravel and I sell a few loads of it and it's not paying even the equipment costs that I incurred in the beginning, I don't think that should trigger an automatically, because it creates a situation where you don't even want to help your neighbor, because you might be in the situation that you trigger that event and all of a sudden you get half your expenses. So I'm concerned about the way that was described.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I understand that, and at the time of drafting, the concern is that equipment doesn't improperly receive the benefit of these provisions. I'd be happy to consider something else. I don't know how to work the financial aspect of that to come up with a threshold, but perhaps through the assessor's office we can.
We can get Representative Kotek back up, because I think she'll be involved, and okay. You know, we may just be working it out, yeah, and checking with you later.
I think part of the right. Part of the what's nice about a bright line rule is it doesn't subject the counties throughout the state to liability of appeal of their decision, and hence increased work to determine whether or not this person is properly within the plan or not. I guess I'll leave it at that. But
I understand
it is tricky.
I do understand the complexity, but I think there are triggers that you could put in place that, you know, a reasonable person would expect that you could recoup kind of the costs for getting the equipment and doing the stuff before you triggered that event. And I think there might be ways to do that, so I'll let them work on that.
Representative, would you like to? Yeah, I'm going to. I think. So are we okay with these gentlemen for the moment? And yeah, please. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Representative Kotek, North and Northeast Portland. Now that I'm a little more awake and I've been reminded of all the details of this case, I really appreciate what the county folks need to do as in terms of collecting property taxes, and they will do their due diligence in trying to understand how this might affect other counties across the state. I will be happy to work with the committee on the amendments. I also want to make sure that I feel that my constituents are feeling a little pressured here, because they're in a bit of a power differential with the county. They're in litigation with them.
No, they're not. They're not at a disadvantage with this committee.
And I appreciate that. And I think we have to look at the amendments with an eye to, is there potential some impact somewhere else? But I think at the end of the day, this is about one farm close to being a century in operation in an urban area. Much beloved, people want it there, and they have made heroic efforts to mitigate the problems on their land to be able to farm. And I think the point that I just want to close with is the one that Mr. Fazio made, which was, if you just drive around and don't talk to them, you really don't know what's going on. And unfortunately, that's what the county assessor did that started this entire process. They didn't do their due diligence at the beginning, and here we are needing to make a fix for a family that just wants to do the right thing. So I'd be happy to work with whomever on the amendments, and we'll come back to you as soon as we can with those. Thank you.
And I will just say, besides the fact that my vice chair said that part better than I could have, a lot of folks in the farming world do get on county assessors if they aren't going after a doctor who's got a couple Christmas trees, and you're wondering what are they doing out there? Are they really farming, or is this just a deal? And so they're in a tough spot. I mean, they hear about it, I'm sure, from the Multnomah County Farm Bureau and others, but this is clearly a little bit different situation than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
That, let me But I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2904. And open a public hearing on House Bill.
I think I can do them both together.
You can tell them.
2215 and 3281 simultaneously.
Thank you.
And I'm going to call up. It's got to be our ODF first, probably.
Which one are we looking at? Which bill?
That's all we've got is Clark, Seeley, and Paul Bell. 2215 and 3281. Okay, then, yeah. So let's start with our agency folks, and then we've got some stakeholders. The bills here, as you might recall, we had an informal, non-bill-related briefing on the fire program and kind of how it works. So the private landowners pay a certain amount, and then the public pays a certain amount, and privates have been paying like 79% to 84% the last few years, and so we've got a couple of bills. Now, actually, did you want to?
No, I think they would go first. It's appropriate, and I my bill just adjusts kind of what they do.
Okay, great.
So I think it's a good idea.
Okay, so why don't you please go ahead, and then we'll move into 3281 really after you describe 2215, and if you have opinions on 3281 while you're here, we'd take them too.
Very good. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Clark Seeley, Associate State Forester with the Department of Forestry here in Salem, joined this morning by Paul Bell, our Chief of our Fire Protection Division. Real pleased to be with you this morning and appreciate your time to talk about this really important topic for Oregon's forest landowners and Oregonians in general. This morning, we'd like to share a bit of testimony on House Bill 2215 specifically, and Paul will do that with us this morning, and we're both obviously here to also help with questions and answers. So, Paul.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I am Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry, and my name is Paul Bell. House Bill 2215 continues a key portion of the current funding structure for emergency wildfire suppression that was established in the 2005 session through House Bill 2327. Emergency wildfires refers to larger fires on lands protected by the department that exceed the initial TAC capacity of our local districts. Prior to the 2003 legislative session and since 1991, forest landowners through the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund provided for the first $10 million of emergency firefighting costs. If costs exceeded that amount, costs were then paid from an insurance policy with a $10 million deductible that have provided for varying amounts of coverage of up to $43 million of insurance at a premium cost for 2002 of over $3.3 million. If costs had exceeded the insurance coverage, all remaining costs would have been presented to the emergency board for reimbursement. As firefighting costs increases outpaced inflation, and the 2001 and 2002 fire seasons each resulted in claims on the insurance policy, it became impossible to renew the insurance for 2003 under similar terms. The premiums, even at higher deductible levels, increased around $500,000 over the next 2 years from that period of time, and a new solution had to be found. A short-term high-cost fix was devised for the 03-05 biennium during that period of time, and House Bill 2327 created the current system in 2005 that we have in place today, and so that's what we're working from at this point. Under the current system, forest landowners agreed on a two-year annual renewal basis to extend the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund annual expenditure limit from $10 million to $15 million. If fire costs exceeded this amount, the general fund through the emergency board would have needed to furnish up to the next $10 million in costs. An insurance policy was purchased with a $25 million deductible, providing $25 million in coverage. The premium cost for the policy currently in place is $907,900, $1,068. And so that's for the current year that we're in. And that policy actually expires at the end of this month, and a new policy will come in place. And we're happy to announce we're able to come in with the same insurance policy for the same premium price coming for starting in April 1st. And that's a real high point and a real testimony to the state of Oregon's fire protection system in this age and time to be able to pick up a $25 million cover policy and not incur increased premium costs. Also, under this structure, a special purpose appropriation within the emergency board for air tankers, helicopters, and other severity type resources, and half of the cost of the insurance premium was established. The current $15 million annual expenditure limit for the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund sunsets this July 1st and will revert to the $10 million if House Bill 2215 does not pass. In that case, the amount necessary from the general fund before reaching the insurance deductible, depending upon actual suppression costs, could be as much as $15 million each fire season. House Bill 2215 proposes to extend the $15 million obligation for another 2 years through to July 1st of 2011. And what I've done is attached to the testimony, and you folks have suffered through this once already, but is what we call our Pulaski chart, and it just shows the different segments of the protection from fire program and the funding sources. And what we are talking about within the system is if you start at the base of the Pulaski and move up about two-thirds, you'll see two blocks of funding there identified as deductibles. The first one is $15 million, and that's the piece we're talking about today, is that $15 million will revert to $10 million, and then the block above that of $10 million would become $15 million. So it's a transition from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund to the general fund. And just also to refresh your memory, if the next chart in the handout shows the actual payouts for the last 4 years out of that fund. In 2005, up $13 million, 2006, $9 million, 2007, $14 million, and 2008, estimated at $10 million at this time. I think I will pretty much, well, just a couple of quick points. I will explain the other two handouts that are attached here that could help you. The kind of spreadsheet attachment shows the history of the insurance program and how it has been paid for and how it plays against this fund that we're talking about. So the first year the state had fire insurance was in 1973. And just a couple of important points as you look down the fourth column over called premium costs. You can see in 73 how we started out at $45,000 for premium costs. And as things have moved across, how those premium costs escalated up to that 04-05 period of $3.8 million, almost $3.9 million, and then with the package that was put together in the 2005 session, how those premium costs now have been able to come down, and then the corresponding insurance deductibles and insurance coverage, and you can also see the payout. And then the last handout I had on here is actually somewhat of a holdover from our last session. Representative Wingard had asked where are these large fires were occurring, and the last handout, the map on the back, is for the same period as the 4 years on the thermometer. The large orange dots on the map correspond to fires that expended greater than $25,000 in 1 day, which kicked them up to make them eligible for expenditures in the out of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. Now, most of these fires run anywhere from $500,000 to up to $5 million in expenditures. Then all the other little dots on the map represent the all the other fires less than that $25,000 over that 4 year period of time, And just a real interesting, as you look at this component for fire distribution, is as you look down in southwest Oregon up through northeast Oregon, that corresponds with the lightning belt in Oregon and corresponds to the fires that come out of that. And then another interesting point is the clusters of the brown dots. As you see, they concentrate around urban areas, urban interface, and the higher numbers. So with that, unless you have questions, I'll...
Questions at this point?
Lots in Representative Gilliam's area.
Okay, I think we're good for the moment.
Okay. I'm going to call Ray Wilkerson, David Ford, and Katie Fast. This is in general about probably both programs, but I've got you down under 3281.
And this
and Christina. I'm sorry. Both of you are on one line. I'm sorry.
You want me to be on this one?
So, Katie. Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
No.
Do you want to go first?
I can just go generally.
Okay.
I'd love to. Sir.
So, let's leave. How about Ray, Christina, and Arnie? Well, no. Let's have Arnie go. Excuse me. Representative Roblin. Representative Roblin.
Okay.
Speaker Pro Tem Roblin. Not Arnie. Speaker Pro Tem Roblin. I'm sorry.
Gosh. We obviously need more coffee.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and distinguished members of the Ag and Natural Resources and Rural Policy Committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am the representative from District 9. As you may know, I started in Ag and Natural Resources in my first session here as a vice chair of this committee, and then last session as chair and in the interim, and then now as a member. And this has been one of the most important issues in my career here at the legislature. And last year, I was fortunate enough at the end of the session to work with the Ways and Means Committee to get it hammered out at the end of the day so that we ended up with the program we currently have. But one of the things that has always intrigued me is we've always considered this a 50-50 program. And it's never been a 50-50 program. And as the more I looked into it, the more I realized that we are really inconsistent. We shouldn't call it a 50-50 program unless we're going to make it a 50-50 program. And history has been fairly clear that it isn't. And in large part, if you look at it, it goes back to the deductible portion. What happens in the current system is that the first $15 million is paid by the landowners. And if you look at the last 3 years, it's never gotten out of that. So the general fund portion of that deductible has been zero for the last 4 years. And if you look at some of the other proposals, it includes changing the bottom section of the deal, which this is the direct taxes, to go from the landowners paying a higher percentage than they currently pay, which is the 50-50. So what this bill does, and the other people behind it will explain it more consistently in other areas where we could go, is it basically says, let's start really doing a 50-50 program where we keep it 50-50, and when it comes to the deductible in particular, we start dollar for dollar, so that if we pay $10 million in costs, that $5 million would have been paid by out of the landowner's portion and $5 million out of the general fund from the very beginning. So we move it as a 50-50. It doesn't make up for the past where they've had to pay a much higher percentage, but it starts getting it where it should be. And I've had people who don't agree with that say, well, you know, there's these tax incentives, all these other kinds of things. And I said, well, then make that fair. Don't confuse it with the fire program. The fire program is a distinct thing that is truly Oregon's way of doing things. We are the only state in the nation that can get an insurance policy anyway. There used to be a Canadian province. I don't know if they still can or not. But Lloyd's of London buys the insurance. We buy it from them. They have continued to do it, and they do it because we take seriously the idea of putting out fires as quickly as we can. And we have two ways that we do that, and they show up here. One of them shows up in this picture, and that is the severity fund. We set aside tankers and others and are ready to go after the fire when it happens. And it costs us money, even if we don't use it, but we know we have it. There's another part of the severity fund that isn't represented here, and that's the landowners. And I will tell you that the reality is any landowner that's near a fire, if the call goes out, they bring their equipment. If they've got bulldozers, if they've got other stuff that are needed at the moment, they are part of that severity fund response action. Their tankers, whatever they have available, they stop what they're doing and they go put out the fire, because everybody recognizes that the reason we have insurance, the reason we've kept our fire costs down, if you look at the total cost in our state compared to anyone around us, it is not comparable. California spends a little bit more money than we do on fire severity.
And the taxpayers pay it all.
And the taxpayers pay it all. Montana, Idaho, I pick any of the western states, and I would say we're the only state that actually really has an idea of understanding how to suppress fires quickly. And it's only going to get worse if global warming continues, and if we have more drought conditions and other kinds of stuff, and if the Florida forest doesn't get their act together and start making it a healthier forest, we are going to continue to have these problems. Now, we don't have to fight the federal forest, but I found that really ridiculous that they're spending the kind of money they do, which they could prevent if they took some of our stuff. But we do stand around waiting if it goes off their stuff for us. So, again, I think the other people can talk more clearly, and there's maybe some other avenues in which we can move forward. But from my perspective, this bill was introduced in cooperation with the people you're going to hear next, clearly on the idea that if we're going to call it a 50-50 share program, let's try to make it a 50-50 share program. And they're willing to pay a little bit more, that extra $5 million in the past, because they also recognize that they weren't just demonstrated on this chart their 50-50 share in that severity program. So they accepted the fact that the government was going to do that, and everybody agreed that that was a really important thing, having those tankers available. And if you realize how important that is when the states around us start having their fires, all of those people those tankers get siphoned off, and there aren't that many of them available. So knowing that we've already paid for them, they're here, we have them in case we have a problem, is really important. With that, I will let the other people talk, and I thank you for your effort, unless you have any questions.
Questions? Representative Wingard.
Yes.
Mr. Speaker, do you have any concerns about the burden that we place on landowners in this state when policy decisions fueled, pardon the pun, by all of the voters in Oregon set up the conditions, in my opinion, for fires that then we place the burden for the cost of those fires on our landowners? We have a unique situation in Oregon where we're not doing what Washington and California are doing as far as burden sharing. I have a concern about voting for the bill when, if it doesn't pass, the burden is placed more on the taxpayers of Oregon, where I think it belongs based on the decisions that are being made that I think lead to more forest fires.
And I guess the part, and this is where I consider the other kinds of things we've done in the past. Oh, sorry, Representative.
Oh, please, no. Yeah.
And the part that where I think we have the conversations about, do we give the tax incentives and the tax breaks that we do to farm? We heard today what that differential was. Do we give those tax breaks to forest? And I think if you saw the differential, not as much as farm, but they have a differential as well. That's part of the public saying, we care about what you do and why you're doing it, so we're going to charge you less tax that way. And therefore, they come forward and say, we're going to help with this firefighting costs in our way. So, I mean, I think there is that deal, and I think sometimes we confuse those two at different times. But I think the landowners have come to the conclusion, as long as they don't raise taxes over here too much, they're willing to pay their part over here. So, I mean, if they were paying the full share, which in some states they do, there isn't a differential between forest taxation and some other places, that's a bigger discussion we have to have with everything. And so I kind of compartmentalize my thinking about that one and saying, I'll fight that battle over here with respect to how we pay our general taxes that go into those kinds of things, and the general taxpayer in those urban areas pays more taxes for their property than we do. Some of that same money is what goes into some of these things. They do pay an extra cost, and I do agree with you that we'd better start thinking more and more as we start encroaching out into these, because they create a costlier firefighting situation when we have at the urban interfaces, and when we have people that decide to go out and build a house out there and they think that these fire groups are going to go save their house first, which they really shouldn't. I mean, the issue of this stuff is to go fight the fire and not worry about those things. But the reality is life and safety always cause an issue. You always have to go do it. So it changes how you go attack the fire at times, and that's a little frustrating, those of us that live out there in those natural resource areas. But I think that's a bigger conversation that we need to continue to have. But I don't think it's one that, from my perspective, goes down to this particular bill. Unless they've tried to change it in another side.
I have a feeling you might be thinking, if it's like my opinion, that the people don't believe we should log on federal lands and instead have nature just start fires, that's who maybe should pay for it. But I don't know how we're going to get the federal government to pay when it comes onto our land. I'm sure they do pay quite a bit on their lands, but I don't know that we send them a bill for...
We don't.
Yeah. But, yeah, well...
It does pay for the other part of the half, and I guess that... Yeah, I mean, I do understand your concern. I just want to fix this one right now, and then we'll go have some conversation.
We'll be over in land use today talking about fire and people building in the woods, too. So Representative Winger and I get to talk about this all day long.
And separately on top of this one, if I may, you probably have a chance to talk about birdseed taxes in the future, which help hunting and other kinds of issues. So, I mean, there are ways where we're looking at trying to figure out how other people can help with some of the costs of managing wildlife and taking care of our resources.
Yesterday, somebody in my office was telling about their plan for voluntary buck a bird. You see a bird, you just send a buck into ODF&W if you're out watching them, and if you see a flock, it's five. Field discount. And just voluntarily send it in, and then
there are some unique birds that come here rarely. They should be more. But other than that, I'd have to agree.
Well, like the representative said, let's get the people to know what they're talking about.
Exactly. Always appreciative.
It was voluntary. It wasn't tax. Just buck a bird.
Keep us in our place. That's nice.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Okay. Let's see if I can get this right now. Ray Wilkinson, Christina McNitt, and David Ford.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkinson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. Christina is also speaking for OFIC today. We were going to split up OFIC's contribution to this a little bit with me kind of providing some background and describing the problem that we think needs some attention. And Christina more or less describing the solution that appears in House Bill 3281. My part is going to be easy because both Paul Bell and Representative Roblin has done a good job of describing the background and how we got to where we are. But just a couple of points on that. This is a program that we should all be proud of in the state of Oregon. We clearly have the best wildland firefighting program in the world, illustrated by the fact that we're the only ones that can get an insurance policy. And it is based on a partnership, and it's been around since 1911, and it's based on a true working relationship between the forest landowners and the state of Oregon. A couple of points to Representative Wingard's comment about what is the role or responsibility or obligation should be of the general public or general taxpayers, and that's a good point, a good question, because this is private forest land, but there's a lot of public values at risk from forest fires. Air quality, water quality, if you have a bad forest fire and then you get heavy rains in the winter, that really does a lot of damage to streams. Nowadays, fish and wildlife habitat burns up. That's a public value. And nowadays, we're all concerned about climate change, and the role of forests for carbon sequestration is obviously a value to the public and a reason why the forest, if we can keep them from burning up, that's a good thing. Paul Bell described the process that got us to where we were in 2002. We had a very bad fire season. The global insurance markets changed. We could no longer get an insurance policy with a $10 million deductible, so something had to change with the program. So we worked very hard during the interim in 2004 to come up with the system we have now. Our contribution to that was to increase our exposure annually to these large fire suppression costs from $10 million to $15 million. We asked at that time that a sunset be applied to that bill. Let's see how this is going to work. It was a new system, and that's the reason this bill is before you this year, because this bill either continue the $15 million or it will go back to the $10 million. So that's basically the choice. We would like to and will support continuing that higher obligation, the higher responsibility, but we think that the system needs to be, the equities need to be rearranged because it hasn't worked exactly like we expected, and the costs have been much higher on the landowners than the state, despite the goal of 50-50. Before I stop, we've attached some more or less kind of random information to our handout here, but I think there's some good data here that's worthy of your attention. This first graph just shows collectively how bad badly the goal of 50-50 we've missed. And Chairman Clam mentioned the 84% earlier, and this graph illustrates that. The graph right below is the base fire protection budget. This is the cost of just maintaining the fire department, which is, even if you don't have any fires, you've got to be prepared to fight fires, and that's a high cost. This is divided 50-50, but the rate of inflation on that has gone up a lot higher than general inflation, so that's another thing that makes this tough for landowners. Right at the bottom of that first page, there's a statistic about the greenhouse gas emissions effect of forest fires, and another reason why we should all try to make sure we have as few fires as possible.
Which page is that one right
there? Right at the bottom of that first page, there's one statistic about how many tons of carbon emissions are avoided if you can avoid a fire. The red bars chart on the next page shows one of the reasons why these costs have gone up so much. That's that fire conditions, and Representative Roblin mentioned this, fire conditions have gotten much more severe. This is Northeast Oregon. Between 91 and 97, there were only 21 days a year on average where the fire conditions were very, very severe, which means if you start a fire, getting it put out quickly is going to be tough. But in the subsequent years, there's 44 days a year where you have those extreme conditions, and that's another factor. Representative Roblin also mentioned the landowners, when the fire bill goes off, they show up, and that this middle chart right here reflects the conclusion of a study the Department of Forestry has done over the last couple of years to try to quantify the in-kind contributions of landowners to this program, and the bottom line is $13.6 million a year is what we, in addition to the taxes we pay, that we contribute in kind. This chart right here shows the tax increase overall, and Christina will talk about how we got to that big increase in the emergency fire fund. The next page is a comparison of western states and what the fire costs are, and Representative Roblin also mentioned these, and this has got some good information. The only state that comes close to Oregon is Nevada, and they don't have very many trees, so it's kind of a false comparison. But compared to California and Washington, the landowners here are paying significantly more, even at 50-50, than those other two states. And the final thing, and then I'll turn this over, this is the last page is a hypothetical, but it kind of puts this in the perspective of how a real landowner is affected by this. This is a hypothetical Eastern Oregon landowner who owns 10,000 acres of mixed timber and grazing land. That land in Eastern Oregon is not very valuable. It's not very productive. Your ability to generate revenue off that land, particularly now, is very limited. But that hypothetical landowner would be paid at $1.82 an acre, just for the base fire program, would be paying $18,000 a year in fire patrol costs, fire protection costs. And, you know, where is that landowner going to get the revenue stream in this kind of economy to write a check for $18,000? So, and we had some folks that came at the informational hearing from around the state. They're going to show up again in front of the Ways and Means Committee when the public testimony of the department's budget. But this is the sort of real impact that it has, particularly in these more remote portions of the state. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And first, let me thank you again sincerely for having the opportunity, not once but twice, to talk in depth about forest fire funding in Oregon. It is a big, big, huge deal. And although we have a world-class, unique fire protection system in Oregon, we're at a tipping point, which you heard from us in January, where the landowners really potentially could have their back broken. Representative Roblin, it's a pleasure to work with you and to hook up with other legislators who not only understand and respond to this concern, but can articulate it back to your colleagues, and that's very, very important. When we spoke in January, Ray and I, we talked briefly about House Bill 2215, which was in your possession. That's the bill that extends the $10 million deductible first paid by landowners to $15 million. And we told you that we had a legislative concept draft coming your way soon. And so the difference today is that legislative concept draft is now House Bill 3281. And we're very supportive of both pieces of legislation. Basically, what House Bill 3281 does is it focuses on the cost of extraordinary fire. So we're not talking about the base Forest Protection Association budgets, the 12 protection associations across the state. That's something that's dealt with in the Department of Forestry's budget and is already residing in Ways and Means. And, by the way, based in the governor's recommended budget, there is a 10% cost shift in that budget starting from day one onto landowners that shifts the 50-50 relationship on that level to 45-55. So that's one issue we will have to address in Ways and Means. But once a fire exceeds the ability of a local protection district to control it, then you start tapping into the Forest Land Protection Fund. And that's a fancy name for saying the landowner's fee fund. There are a number of taxes that OSWA and OFIC jointly agreed to support last session to the tune of a 25% increase across the board. In my testimony, which is basically regurgitated from January, but on page 2, there is a list of those fees that landowners are currently paying, including the forest products harvest tax, which you heard about on Tuesday, and that bill's on its way or will be to revenue and then also to Ways and Means, a per-acre assessment for grazing lands, assessments for Eastern Oregon timberlands and Western Oregon timberlands, minimum lot assessments, and then improved lot surcharges. All of those fees combined are what funds the Forest Land Protection Fund. And even with that 25% increase that we passed on to our landowners in 2005, the fund still went broke. And so there was an additional assessment because the Emergency Fire Cost Committee had to borrow $5 million from the state treasury. And the end result is that landowners got socked with an 88% increase in their fire fund fees. That's just not sustainable. So House Bill 3281 contemplates that the same amount of deductible would exist, the overall $25 million, but rather than the forest landowners being responsible to fully pay the first $15 million of that deductible, and then once that $15 million is exhausted, the state general fund meets the next $10 million. We're proposing that from the first dollar, this really is truly a partnership, a 50-50 relationship, meeting the deductible. In theory, it has been structured that way. If you look at how the agency budgets are passed every biennium, the potential exposure for the state of Oregon, the reservation has always been there. Lucky for us, we haven't had the catastrophic fire years that have dipped into that full $25 million of our deductible or the insurance, which is probably a good thing, or we might not be getting insurance again. But the unintended or unforeseen consequence of how we structured it in the 2003 interim with 2005 legislation is that it really, in actuality, is not a 50-50 relationship. It's only 50-50 in theory in the worst-case scenario. So we would like to make it a true 50-50 relationship and believe that the provisions of House Bill 3281 would do so. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Wingard. And I know we do have one more on this panel. Do you want to do it now or after? Okay. David, why don't you go ahead and then we'll...
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is David Ford. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, representing small family woodland owners here today. I'll make this very brief. We're strongly in support of these two bills, and my colleagues have done an excellent job of both briefing this committee in the past as well as articulating the reasons why we're here today in full support of this bill. And I want to also thank Representative Roblin for all his efforts. He did an outstanding job of explaining it. And this is a very, very important issue to small family woodland owners that are under a lot of pressure to be able to maintain their lands in a forested land condition and in family ownership. So with that, I will participate in any of the questions that you have. Thank you.
Representative Wingard.
I think I understand. I just want to have it repeated back to me. So we go up to 25 million. Currently, the landowners are on the hook for the first 15. Then the state pays the additional 10. So the two bills work in tandem. You're keeping the 15 that the landowners have to participate in at 15 rather than having it revert back down to 10. But you want that now to be split 50-50. So in actuality, you're not on the hook for 15. You're on the hook for about 7.5.
No.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, and that is something we need to finesse, but we're willing as forest landowners to continue the cap at $15 million. So actually, the total amount of the insurance deductible remains the same at $25 million. The difference would be that potentially landowners would have to pay up to 12.5, and the state would have to pay up to 12.5. And the difference is that we would be doing that jointly. So one pot of money wouldn't be exhausted before the other pot of money is utilized.
So are you going to... I'm sorry.
Yeah, please.
Call me Claire.
Please follow.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
No, everyone else calls me Claire.
Claire.
Claire. Claire Jim.
Claire Jim.
Just, it's fine.
I am not healthy enough to follow this, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're suffering
so
up here.
The landowners would pay the first $12.5 million, or you're going to share dollar for dollar up to $25 million, right? Which would prevent you from going beyond 12.5 million. So essentially, there's not even really a $15 million cap. You're kind of capped at 12.5 million, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, I'll answer one question, and then I think that Ray wants to jump in there too. But the key principle behind this bill is that we split the deductible from the first dollar. So rather than having either party pay a large chunk of their funds before the other party starts to partner in, the key concept is that it's the first dollar. The landowner pays, and then the general fund pays. So it's a joint effort in these large project fires. And then you're right, there is a $25 million deductible right now, which technically isn't in statute, but that happens to be the provisions of the insurance policy that was just purchased. And so half of 25 is $12.5 million. You're correct about that. Ray.
If I could just add a couple of things, Mr. Chairman. One, as Christina just said, this is based on the current insurance policy. So in the future, the state could buy an insurance policy with a $30 million deductible, mm-hmm. and that would be 15 and 15. The other thing is that the statute, and this would continue with both these bills passing, we pay half the premium costs. So right now, with a $25 million policy, theoretically, our exposure is 12.5 plus $500,000 roughly for the premium. And the third point I'd like to make is with these two bills passed the way they are, our exposure would be $15 million. And in a worst-case scenario, we burn through the entire coverage of the policy. And this has happened in other states. Montana, Washington, California obviously have had $100 million fire seasons. If that happens, and God forbid it does, you know, once we get past the insurance policy, the remainder of our obligation would kick in at that point before the general fund would have to pay any more. So there's several reasons why that $12.5 million is either a function of the current policy, which could change, or there's other factors that would cause us to expend the entire $15 million cap.
Follow up. Okay. Could be because I'm sick, but I want you to walk through this. So, under the current law, if we have a $10 million fire year this year and a $20 million fire year this year, for those two scenarios, landowners are on the hook. Well, for the $10 million, they pay the full $10 because they don't even get to. So that's it. The landowners pay. On a $20 million fire year, currently you pay up to $15 million, and then the taxpayers are on the hook for the last $5 million. If these bills pass, what changes under those two scenarios?
Representative Wingard, if these two bills pass on a $10 million fire year, the landowners would pay $5 million, the state would pay $5 million. On a $20 million fire year, the landowners would pay $10 million, the state would pay $10 million, 50-50.
Exactly.
From dollar one.
Okay. Thank you.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. Okay, any other questions for these three? Mm-hmm. Representative Byer.
Yes. I'm speaking.
All of us have to say.
There. In your mind, and we haven't ever, I mean, recently, we haven't gone past that insurance policy where all additional costs go to the general fund. In Representative Roblin's bill, do you feel like that language is still protected, or do you feel like you might be at risk during it, in that language?
Chair Clem and Representative Byer, we They're actually, the $15 million cap is not included in the 3281 language, and we will we will be finessing that. Shall I just present to the committee what we've been talking about? All right. So ultimately, I believe that when we come back and have a work session on this bill, the provisions of House Bill 3281 will be amended into House Bill 2215. Just so it's easier, we don't have to keep track of two different bills, and if one passes, then we support the other, and blah blah. While we're doing that, we are interested in making sure that the $15 million number is included in that language.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm done. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Representative Van Orman.
It's about the insurance cost. Are we confident that this is what the rate is going to be?
Premium rate?
Premium rate, yes, thank
it.
You.
I think we just bought it already.
Mm-hmm. We have, all right. Thank you.
For now.
That answers the question.
It will go up in the future. Yeah, for 2 years?
This year.
This year.
Oh, just 1 year.
Oh, is it one?
It's
an annual policy.
So for 1 year.
Okay. But, well, that's good news.
It represents everyone.
But we already have an understanding that whatever that cost goes up to, we share 50-50. That's a 50-50 share no matter what. So if the insurance policy goes up, the landowners and state pay 50-50 right. in the future.
That's already in the law.
Cap the total landover cost at $15 million, including their share of the deductible.
Right.
Correct.
Only because this policy is at 20. Wait, what was that? Hold on. What was that last part? We're going to cap the.
Their total expenditures are going to be capped at $15 million. So right now their share of the deductible is $500,000. So they're in for $14.5 million extra for firefighting costs beyond their share of the deductible. But as the deductible goes up, their cap's still $15 million, so their share of the firefighting costs will be reduced a little bit if the deductible is going up. Or at least their total output of dollars,
right.
I should say.
Their initial output will go up higher, but their total exposure is the same. I think that's true.
So I have a feeling in future legislatures we talking about.
Yeah,
right. Mr. Chair, Representative Wingert is correct. The first expenditure every year out of the landowner fund is the premium for the half of the premium for the insurance policy, because we buy the insurance before the fire season starts, obviously. So we've already committed out of that $15 million cap, $500,000 for our share of the premium.
Yep. Okay. One more bill we're going to try and go through. We still need to hear from Katie Fast and Bill Cluding. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Klim, members of the committee, I'll keep my comments very brief since you do have more work to do today. And for the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau participated in the 2004 interim fire work group that brought the increased portion for landowners up to $15 million. We are supportive of the two bills moving in tandem or the amendments that are, I think, in the process of being drafted that Ms. McNitt referenced to. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Bill.
Thank you, Chair Klim. Committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. I'd like to let you know that my members fully endorse these two House bills, 2215 and 3281. If anything, we need them more now. And I'll, for the record, I'd like to explain my thoughts on this.
Relatively quickly, Bill, because I didn't even have you signed up, and I got one more bill still.
Real quick, sir. We just inherited another 200,000 acres of wilderness land. Now, what this means, the average person doesn't know, that's a load off the federal government, but it's a load on the state of Oregon. By that, I mean we cannot fight a fire on a wilderness area. We cannot stop a two-acre fire. We have to wait till it burns to somebody's boundary. Again, we need all the insurance we can get. Thank you, sir.
Questions? Great. Thank you very much. So I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3281. You know what I'd like to do quickly is request a rules suspension to allow Representative Van Orman to vote on House Bill 2424, if there's no objection. Seeing none, let me get, so reopen a work session on House Bill 2424. And Ezra, would you call the roll? Or did you?
In person. Yeah. No, just ask her.
Okay, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman votes aye.
That tipped the balance on that.
Yeah, that. Oh, boy, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Wisdom's going to be happy with you now. And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 24. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189. And call Travis Medina and Paul Bell. And might as well get Mike Dykstel on his way. Pass the Senate 29-0, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Let's just know that because we got 11 minutes. Let's see how we're off the floor. Just trying to, a little work done around here.
Trying to sway me.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, I'm Paul Bell, Protection Division Chief for the Oregon Department of Forestry. And Travis Medina, our Deputy Chief, will provide the testimony and will be available for answer questions. And he is very quick.
I'll go very fast, Chair Clem. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Travis Medina, Deputy Chief, Fire Protection for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Just want to take a couple few minutes to run through briefly what Senate Bill 189 is about. And it really speaks about this base level of fire protection. We've heard about the emergency costs. We're talking about the base level and the funding for this. And it's based off of Forest Patrol assessments. The Department of Forestry provides fire protection on 16 million acres of forest land. A primary source of revenue for this fire protection is this Forest Patrol assessment, this base level, and that comes from owners of forest land. Forest land classification has a long-standing history in Oregon. It dates back to its inception in the late 30s and then statewide adoption in the 50s. Many things have changed in Oregon since the late 30s, as we all know, and the agency has continued over time to make modifications to forest land classification to keep up with the times. Senate Bill 189 is one of these modifications to update and maintain the laws within this rapidly changing environment. In 2007, a work group was convened, comprised of stakeholders such as OFIC, Small Woodlands, the Bureau of Land Management, other state agencies such as Fire Marshals, Chiefs Association, Association of Oregon Counties, and the Assessors Association, along with ODF staff and field districts. There were four principal changes and recommendations to forest land classification, very minor stuff, adding a representative from the Fire Marshal's office, allowing these county classification committees to classify lands in multiple counties, clarifies that structures are present on forest land and assists with classification efforts in the urban interface, rapidly expanding urban interface, and then lastly provides some minor housekeeping in Chapter 477 to keep things consistent. These changes were recommended and supported by the committee, and these are the key components of Senate Bill 189. I'd like to thank you guys for your time and would answer any questions on Senate Bill 189 if you guys have questions.
Hear from Mike real quick.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Dykstel, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. As Mr. Medina recounted, I was a member of the steering committee of the 2007 review. I was also a co-chair of one of the subcommittees of the Consistency Assurance Group. Mm-hmm. As you can imagine, all the varieties across the state, our fences are down and our sheep are all over the field, but trying to pull them back together with the assessors, it was an excellent effort. As we had a fantastic discussion by the committee just previously, as we talk about the urban interface and the number of people that are moving out into the forest lands, we love neighbors, but it does further complicate our primary mission of putting out fires when they're small and being able to move that fire trail along, you know, the head of the fire to pinch it off. As soon as you get a number of structures out there, it does complicate. It increases the prices. The cost of fire protection, it just goes through the roof. Through the committee's work, we reviewed an awful lot of different areas around the state. We took several field trips, and whether it be workloads or the formations of classification committees, it was obvious that there is a number of people that are receiving services out there are not on the books, and this the tools that gives us today is to get everybody that's receiving services a process to contribute into the classification process, as I said, and to be contributing towards the cost of protection, which hopefully will stabilize things. So in the interest of time, I'll leave it there.
Representative Irwin.
Yeah, I just want to, because I think there's some new members of the committee.
Yep.
This also took into consideration the fire protection agencies that are not state-run in making sure these corrections work for them as well. Because right now the state has the fire protection responsibility for a vast amount of the state. But there are certain fire protection groups like Coos and Douglas and Sure. Out Band and all those. And they were involved in this as well, correct?
That is correct, okay. Representative Roebling.
Wow.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Gillian.
What's the schedule like? Is this the only
one? Yeah, one more. Ralph Saperstein, and then that's it.
I wanted to ask a question that's a little bit off subject, so maybe we need to pick it up
surprising.
Later. But I ask you about having a couple folks come in and talk about an issue related to this. And this is my question. Some of our employees in your department do double duty, and I wanted you to say more about that. So in other words, they have responsibilities, 8-to-5 responsibilities throughout the year, but then when we hit fire season, we're asking them to do a lot more. And I think that's worth putting on the record of what they have to do when we get into a fire situation. It was of great interest to me.
Chair Klim, Representative Gillum, I'd love to address that question. You're exactly right. I think most committee members do know the success of the Oregon Department of Forestry is based on that every employee within the Department of Forestry carries fire duty responsibilities. While their primary job may be in state forest and laying out timber sales, or they may be a stewardship forester administering the Forest Practices Act or doing landowner assistance, when we have a fire, those people train and carry the qualifications to be our division supervisors, our incident commanders, and that's what makes this system work. And so there is quite concern as we look at the budget issues we have we're going to, as timber revenues have fallen, it'll impact our state forest and our staffing levels in there, as well as then how the rest of the budget issues play out across our other programs. And so, but I can't stress the importance of those employees to the success of this fire program.
And a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
So
they get paid for it, but if we remove an FTE in one of those areas, then we lose more than that 8-to-5 person. We lose our firefighter.
Yes, sir.
Yep. And I'll just tack on that real quick. I mean, for a division supervisor on a fire, we probably invest about $30,000 in training to get that person to be qualified, and then the rest of the time they're doing their regular duties.
Good. Okay, I think you three are relieved of questions. Or did you want to?
No,
you had some.
I
have one more too coming up.
I know this is slightly off topic, and I know we're running out of time. But this is the third or fourth time in this committee that the issue of people building homes in fire-prone areas or forest areas has come up. And I realize that we have an assessment, and we are asking people to build those homes to contribute. I'm wondering though if there's been ever, and I guess I throw this out to the committee too. Has there ever been a policy discussion about setting up a program whereby a person who builds a home out of one of these areas, who takes certain steps or builds using certain materials or creates a scenario where their home is unlikely to be in danger even from a forest fire because of how they build it or what they build it out of, that they get some kind of a discount or they're relieved of some of this obligation so that there's an encouragement for people who do build in these areas to build in a way that doesn't require us to...
We did it last session. Why don't you describe what we did last session?
Okay. I'm happy to be educated.
Yeah. Chair Klim, Representative Wingard, yes, we do have a program in place that actually originally originated in the 97 session as Senate Bill 360 and became known as the Wildland Urban Interface Act. And what we did last session was make adjustments, amendments to it to clean it up and make it better. But it is a process of where the Department of Forestry works with the counties to implement standards around residences as well as then help them work with like FireWise Community and Fire Safe to make those homes safer. And the act in itself has components in it in regards to working with the landowners, but in those areas, and it's been a progression of getting it established. Right now, we have 12 counties, and I've actually got a list, but I won't read through them, that have enacted the Wildland Urban Interface Act. And just the bottom line with it is the best thing about it is it's an educational tool to work with landowners that live in that interface area. But it does carry some teeth in regards to landowners that once their land is classified in that Wildland Urban Interface or WUI, that they if they have not gone through the process to make their lands more fire safe around their structures, they could be held liable for up to $100,000 of cost of a wildfire determined to have started or spread as a condition of their fuel loadings
on their property. Yeah.
And so that is now in 12 counties. We're working on three different counties right now. Hood River County is just started, and I'm.
That part, well, wasn't that new? It wasn't just cleanup last time. We did that, didn't we? That said, if you don't do these things, or all I know is I got a mailing for the first time on a place along the Umpqua that said you're now in it and you got to do these things or else you're on the hook. So something was new. Maybe just Douglas County came into it last year?
Yes, sir, Chair Klim. We've started to progress around the state and initially started in the highest residential areas, so that was in Deschutes and Jackson County, and then have just progressed along the state and hope to get to all counties. And like
you got to me last year. Thank you. I had to go clear a bunch of brush around. It was good. I needed to.
Well, I guess just one quick follow-up. I hear that there's a program that basically says you're going to do this because, I mean, who could afford that liability? But I'm wondering if I bought a piece of property in forest land and I wanted to build a home, and I mean, what little I know about this, it is possible to build a structure that's, I mean, you can do this in a way where you're very unlikely in a fire to lose you because of what you build it out of and what you could do to surround it. Is there any way for me to be rewarded by that, by the investment that I put into doing that, by being relieved of some of the assessment or in some way? Because obviously part of the assessment is that, you know, that's the first place you go to protect because it's a residence. But if I've created a scenario where you don't have to panic and rush out of the fire to protect me, do I get any relief from that?
Chair Klim, Representative Wingard, just first off, with the Department of Forestry, our job is to protect the forest resource from burning up. So when the fire occurs, we're going to go put that fire out. With the structures in place, what that does is increase our cost and the type of tactics we use to put the fire out. In regards to the more incentives for landowners to build those types of structures, but we do have educational programs in place, as well as we've worked with the insurance industry to...
I'm just going to have us go offline for that. I got to get this bill done. Let's have Ralph go. We can have a conversation.
Ralph Sepperstein on behalf of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. Once again, not substantive testimony. This is me too. OSWA had two participants in the work group that was described to you, and we are in support of the reclassification system. And Paul Bell would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
That's good. Okay. That's the end of my list. Would committee members prefer to just go ahead and vote, or would you like to wait?
I'll give you a motion.
Yeah, so let me open a work session. Senate Bill 189.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Rowe.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Excused.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Benham.
Aye.
Vice Chair Green.
Aye.
Chair Clement.
Aye. Senate Bill 189 is, I'm on my script, declared passed and is moving to the floor. Consent calendar, it's 29-0 on the Senate. Anybody problem with consent calendar?
No.
The only reason I'm against that is I'd like to have him carry it, of course. And I just think this point is worth our colleagues, our urban colleagues, hearing.
But is that an actual objection?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, then. So Representative Gilliam is going to be here.
I'll work on it right next time. I will.
Fair enough.
And with that,
I have one parting shot. Well, if we're all concerned about building in forest land, just require them to hook up to a sewer.
We're going to use gray water.
I'm adjourning. Yeah, right. Adjourning a meeting.
Nicely done.